Good morning, friends. I read a few articles in the week that I've spent some time thinking about. A few folk have told me that they don't read or listen to the news anymore because they find it depressing. And I understand why they may say so, but I think I've got to a point where the news doesn't actually depress me. I find that most of it just irritates me instead, especially when one witnesses people behaving badly. The articles I've been reading this week have to do with the coronavirus. Two of them were about illegal raves that seemed to be popping up all over the country, and the other had to do with a holiday flight that was described by one passenger as horrifying and shocking. One rave, somewhere in Wales apparently, attracted about 3,000 people who had travelled from all across the UK to attend it. The police eventually put an end to it, but not before the local inhabitants had to put up with the loud music, unruly crowds, and people using their countryside as a toilet. The report said the racket could be heard some 14 miles away. On the holiday flight from somewhere in Spain to Cardiff, passengers seemingly ignored all the rules about keeping safe, with about half the plane not wearing face coverings or masks, and people wearing masks but around their necks like necklaces. Groups of people apparently were shouting at each other across the cabin, and according to the horrified passenger, the flight attendants were largely useless at trying to keep any order. In fact, it seems they didn't bother. On that flight, if my memory serves me correctly, 16 people ended up testing positive for COVID-19. Across the pond, I saw pictures of a Republican Party get-together at the White House. The guests at the party were sitting right on top of one another, and hardly any, if any at all, were wearing face coverings or masks. After reading these articles, my first reaction, I have to confess, was one of anger. I couldn't believe how stupid and selfish we as human beings can sometimes be. But as I thought about it a little longer and began to ponder why people might behave in this way, I began to think that maybe they're afraid. Maybe people feel vulnerable or have come face to face with their own mortality for perhaps the first time, and this has made them fearful in such a way that they're behaving as if life has returned to normal and there's just nothing to worry about, when deep down in their hearts, they know that this is not the truth. Perhaps some, especially younger people, have felt invincible, as if they have nothing to fear, and that may be true for some, but I tend to believe that there is fear involved. The truth is, friends, we live in a scary world. Just the other day, I was reflecting on stories my mom told us, her children, about what it was like as a child during the war. Living in Loughborough, she said she can remember seeing Coventry burning as the German bombers went to work, how the sky was bright orange from the flames. She told us about wearing gas masks that smelt all rubbery, ones they had to don when the air raid sirens would wail, and the German doodle bugs chugging overhead, and how scary it was when the chugging stopped, because it meant the bomb was about to land. How truly frightening that must have been. I thought of all the conflicts the world has seen since that time, and the answer is 286. 286 conflicts across the world in the matter of 75 years. The world, friends, is a scary place. And so how do we deal with the issue of fear, of being fearful? We can act, as many seem to do, as if that which might make us fearful doesn't exist. We can seek to run away from that which makes us fearful. We can give in to that which makes us fearful. But the problem with all of the above is the fact that they don't actually deal with the fear or being fearful. We can rave until we're blue in the face, for example, but the virus will still be there. We can flout all the guidance we've been given and act as if everything's normal, or hope it'll simply disappear like a certain world leader. But wishful thinking hasn't helped in the past, and it isn't going to help in the present, and it isn't going to help in the future. So I would like to suggest a solution, an answer to the question of fear, and it has to do, as you might have guessed, with Jesus. I know some might say, what's wrong with Christians? They seem to think Jesus is the answer to everything. And this morning, I want to suggest that he is, and not in any supernatural, magical kind of way, even though the stories we are going to look at have a miraculous bent. Instead of concentrating solely on these aspects of the stories, we're going to ask, what were they meant to teach those who first heard them? And what do they teach us today? In the Gospel according to Matthew chapter 8 and verse 23, we are told that after Jesus had preached what we call the Sermon on the Mount, and after he had healed many people at Peter's house, Jesus got into a boat and his disciples followed him. They were, the author of Matthew tells us, going to the other side. What was on the other side? It was largely a Gentile region known as the Decapolis. And going to the other side was a move that would sort out the passionate followers of Jesus from the nominal ones, just as we witness in the preceding stories of chapter 8. As they sailed along, a storm came up. But this wasn't any old storm. And it was more than a very violent storm, for the Greek words used literally meant a great shaking. In other words, an earthquake, which caused their boat to take on water. And the disciples, fearing that they were going to die, went and woke Jesus up, and they cried out to him, Lord, save us! We are perishing. We're told that Jesus, having slept through most of the commotion, got up, asked the disciples why they were afraid, scolded them for their little faith, and then rebuked the winds and the waves, and the water grew dead calm. The word rebuked in this sentence being the same word used when Jesus rebuked evil spirits. We are told that the disciples were amazed and they asked, what sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? Well, the kind of man who would possess the power of a creator and have authority over all things. 5 chapters later in the Gospel of Matthew, after John the Baptizer had been killed by Herod and Jesus had fed the 5,000, we are told that Jesus wanted to spend some time on his own so that he could pray. So he put his disciples in another boat and he told them to go ahead, again, to the other side. When evening came, Jesus was finally alone. But the disciples again were in all sorts of trouble, for once again the wind had picked up and the waves were hammering their boat. Early in the morning, though, Jesus came to them. But he wasn't in his own boat. Instead, he was walking on the water. When the disciples saw him, they didn't realize it was Jesus, we are told. They thought they had seen a ghost, and they cried out in fear. But immediately, we are told, Jesus spoke to them. Take heart, it is I, he said. Do not be afraid. Something important to note in the words of Jesus is his statement, it is I. For this can also be translated as ego I me, which means I am, which we witness when Moses encountered God in the burning bush. When Moses asked him who he was, God replied, I am who I am. The author of Matthew's gospel thus is pushing us towards the idea of Jesus' divinity, which is largely what these passages are actually about. The disciple Peter, always the eager one, spoke to Jesus saying, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And Jesus simply said, come. And so Peter, rather bravely, it has to be said, with his eyes firmly fixed on Jesus, got out of the boat and did by grace what he couldn't do by nature. He walked across the water. And all went well until Peter took his eyes off Jesus and he looked around. Then he noticed the winds and the waves and he began to sink. "Lord, save me," Peter cried. And Jesus reached out and lifted him up. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" This, friends, wasn't a statement of condemnation. Rather, it was a simple correction, for Peter, despite his doubts, had shown great faith in climbing out of the boat in the first place. When they got into the boat, we are told, the wind ceased. And those in the boat, having witnessed all they had seen, worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This lets us know that the disciples realized that what God had done in the Hebrew scriptures, like stilling troubled waters or saving the faithful from drowning, was being echoed in Jesus. And although Matthew's author didn't cite any passages, for those steeped in the scriptures, the import would have been quite obvious. Jesus was the Lord over creation, with godly authority over all things great and small. Understanding this, then, what we need to take away from these stories is relatively simple. And that is, when Jesus is in the boat, we have nothing to fear. Put another way, when we face the storms of life, and all of us will face them, we will never be alone because the Spirit of Christ and of God will be within us and we will have nothing to fear. But you might ask, well, what does this actually mean? And let me answer this question by first telling you what it doesn't mean. Friends, it doesn't mean that we'll be invincible and we'll never face the struggles of life. It doesn't mean we won't ever face fear-inducing situations. It doesn't mean that every fiber of our being will not be tested to the nth degree. But it does allow us to know that no matter what we might face or go through, we will be okay in and through the presence of Jesus. But it means more than that. It means more than the knowledge that Jesus is with us. We're told in Psalm 23, for example, the famous psalm, that the good shepherd not only accompanies his sheep through the darkest valleys, but he leads them to good pastures and quiet waters. In the context of fear and being fearful, I believe this means that Jesus gives us the means to face the things that cause us to be fearful or to fear. He provides us with all we need to live and endure. In the context of life, I believe this would mean taking to heart his teachings, absorbing them into our inner beings, so that what Jesus taught about love, for example, we exude, or what Jesus taught about compassion flows from us, so that the things of God's kingdom, the fruits of God's Spirit, become second nature to us, so that when the storms of life come, or normal life just happens, we have the means to live and not be afraid, to see life, to see lives on a much broader scale and afford them dignity, whether we deem them to be deserving or not. To live our lives not just for ourselves, but to always consider others and the impact that we might have on them. One of the fruits of the Spirit, for example, is self-control, something that seems to fly out of the window when people are fearful. A lack of it often gives rise to self-absorption in people and also selfishness, where others matter less as long as I'm okay. But Jesus calls us to be self-controlled, and by us keeping our eyes on him, he gives us the means. And thus we do not behave rashly, we do not behave selfishly, we do not do things which may harm others and cause them pain. And in such ways, the things we may fear dissipate as we endeavor to do that which is right and good, not only for ourselves, but especially for others. A number of years ago, I was standing in a queue to board a flight down to London. And I noticed a young woman and a friend standing some way in front of me in the queue. I noticed her because she was very loud. And I have to confess, I said a little prayer which went something like this: "Please, Lord, don't let her sit next to me." It was obvious that she had had a lot to drink. And so we boarded the plane and I found my window seat and an elderly woman sat next to me. And guess who was on the end of my row? Yep, the young woman who was chatting to her friends at the top of her voice from the very word go. I decided I'd read a magazine to pass the time. And then I would try to take a nap. But as soon as the flight progressed, the noise next to me got louder and louder. A mobile phone was brought out, and soon the cabin was filled with their terrible music. And then they started to sing at the tops of their voices. And I sat in my seat, my blood pressure rising. When the young woman got up to go to the toilet at some point in the journey, she danced down the aisle. And when she came back to her seat, she began to bounce up and down on it whilst making a racket. The people around me, Spanish tourists, were dead quiet. I don't think they could believe what they were witnessing. And so I leaned across the lady that was sitting next to me, saying, "Excuse me." And I prodded the young woman bouncing on a seat and singing at the top of her voice and said, "Excuse me, would you mind shutting up? We've been listening to your nonsense for 45 minutes, and I think we've had enough." Well, she looked at me as if I'd crawled out of a piece of cheese, made a comment about old people, but she and her friends quickly dried up. And there were huge smiles on the faces of the Spanish tourists, whilst the elderly woman sitting next to me had tried to disappear into her seat. Friends, it's not like me to speak out, but I found as I've got older, I don't care that much anymore. You see, the thing that made me angry wasn't simply the noise and the bouncing on the seat, which I could feel on my end, although that was irritating. It was the lack of thought on the young woman's part and her friends for the people around her who had paid good money for the flight. It was the lack of thought for people who might have been flying for the first time or been fearful of flying. Her lack of self-control impacted all of us and made that hour in our lives very unpleasant. And the flight attendants, well, they did nothing. I left the plane quietly with a young woman surrounded by a group of very angry Spanish tourists, telling her what they thought of her. On a more serious final note for today, when it comes to the issue of fear and the role that Jesus can play in it, I always think of the disciple who stepped out of the boat. I always think of Peter. On the night of Jesus' arrest, Peter, fearful that he had been arrested along with Jesus, denied that he even knew the Lord. Even though he had spent between 1 to 3 years with Jesus, depending on which gospel you read, on his own, he was fearful. But after Jesus reinstated him on the beach after his crucifixion and resurrection and commanded him to feed Jesus' sheep to take care of them, Peter was a different man. Peter was transformed. The fear that had surfaced in him on the night of Jesus' arrest had, I believe, been ushered away. And what replaced it wasn't a rash bravado or simple careless stupidity, but a focus and a faith on and in the one who himself had walked through the deepest, darkest, most painful valley and had emerged triumphant on the other side. We do not have to live in fear or be fearful because Jesus is with us and Jesus leads the way. Let's pray together. Loving God, thank you that in you we have nothing to fear, that your perfect love drives out all fear. And if we are fearful, Lord, for whatever reason, help us to keep our eyes on Jesus, to not only give assent to his name, but to listen to his voice, putting into practice all that he has taught. For we know that when we do, the world is a safer, less fearful place. Be with us, Lord, and lead us, and be with those we love. Be with those in our congregation who are vulnerable at this time. For we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Since God.